Thank you. So I'd like to start with four tenets and an advertisement for a surprisingly good Wikipedia entry for cubism. So these are all taken from there, and they are actually correct. They are abbreviated here. So the first one is that, let me start with saying what this talk is maybe mostly about. It's the claim that the interpretation of probability matters for quantum mechanics, or the interpretation of quantum mechanics or for physics. So the tenets of cubism, which the Wikipedia entry is called quantum Bayesianism. I'm going to say more about whether this is a good name or not later in the talk. So the first tenet is directly about probabilities, and it says that all probabilities, including those equal to 0 or 1, and those derived from pure or mixed quantum states, are, well, valuations that an agent ascribes to his or her degrees of belief, possible outcomes. The second tenet is directly about the Born rule quantum mechanics, which is where it is normative, not descriptive or prescriptive. Quantum measurements are personal experiences for the agent gambling on them. And a measurement apparatus is conceptually an extension of the agent. Now, viewed like this, they're probably a bit puzzling, so I'm going to, I hope by the end of the talk, they have been sort of given meaning. So let me just first say something, again, brief about tenet one. When I say valuations, this points to decision theoretic probabilities, the kind of theory that is used in economics. They're personalist. So they're personal, these valuations are personal to the agent. They are the agent's, best numbers the agents can put on alternatives in order to guide his decision making. Since they're personal, there is no requirement for different agents to assign the same probabilities. And something that is sort of, related here, which I want to say up front, cubism also explicitly rejects the key assumptions of ontological models, so which was very nicely formalized by Harrigan and Speckens. In the ontological model framework, you assume there is an ontological variable, let me call this lambda here, that determines outcome probabilities for any measurements. So this idea is explicitly and from the start rejected here. And I will talk about lambda quite a bit. So in the future, in this talk, when I say lambda, or just write the Greek letter, I mean an ontological variable that determines outcome probabilities of measurements. The second tenet, normative, a Born rule rather than descriptive or prescriptive. So that means the Born rule and the formalism of quantum mechanics is not, in this approach, a law that constrains how nature behaves. It's just a consistency requirement that guides an agent's decision making. The third, about outcomes as personal experiences. We had some discussions about that yesterday and also last week in the Wigner's friend context. And the fourth one, measurement apparatus, is conceptually an extension of the agent. Well, again, we had last week in the meeting last week, which some of you attended, we had discussions about Rob Speckens' idea of cut motility. So there's some connection to that, and we had a discussion on this last week. Maybe the most important thing for this talk here is that an agent is not a person. It's a more fluid concept. And maybe as a definition, as a working definition, the agent is an entity that's capable of using the Born rule normatively. Yes?
Are probability statements here real, in your knowledge?
Sorry?
Do you take the probabilities to be real numbers?
real number as opposed to
rational. Because you said that there are degrees of belief of a person, and I wonder how well that's modeled by a real number.
I don't think it matters much for the approach. But there's no, it's not inconsistent to write down a real number for your degrees of belief.
But I don't think it's very realistic, maybe.
Well, okay, but it's not. It wouldn't be inconsistent. So I don't think it matters in practice, and it wouldn't be inconsistent in theory. So. Let me give some historical context here. There's three. I mean, basically, okay. I would like to claim the following: Cubism is a consistent and coherent approach to quantum mechanics. So, and it's very different. So, paints a very different picture of the world compared to many other interpretations. So, from that perspective alone, I believe it's interesting to study because it's one possible. It's a view about the world, and so one shouldn't rule out any coherent world picture. It's very different, therefore I believe it's interesting, but there are also very strong reasons to adopt it. And each of these roots to cubism actually, I think, gives strong reasons for believing that cubism is the right way of looking at quantum mechanics. So the first one starts with Definetti, it's about probabilities. The second one with Einstein is about hidden variables. The third one is with Wigner, it's about experiences. And I'm going from the back because I'm going to talk more about the first, then about the second, then about the third. So I start with the third one. The third route starting with Wigner in 61, Wigner's friend. Again, we had discussions yesterday. Wigner's friend explicitly, drove the early cubists, Carl Caves and Miss Fuchs and myself, to come up with this idea of facts for the agent, which is also featured in Czaslaw's no-go theorem yesterday. And later, together with Mermin, we just introduced the idea that the best term for this would be experience, but in some sense, it's just a different name for the same thing. And I would claim that the no-go theorems by Czaslaw and by Daniela and Renato, they simply strengthen the cubist case here. The second route starts with Einstein. I should maybe start with 1927. I'm going to, I think, go back to 1927 on my next slide. In a letter to Schrödinger, so this is not the EPR paper, this is a different source, a letter to Schrödinger by Einstein in 1935, he proves that if you assume lambda, so for the last time, if you assume there are hidden variables or real sets of affairs that determine outcomes or their probabilities, well, if you assume that and locality, then psi, the wave function, cannot be a function of lambda. So psi is not determined by lambda. Or in other words, psi is not itself a real set of affairs. Then, extremely well known, in 1961, Bell proved his theorem. Assuming lambda and locality and quantum theory, you'd have a contradiction, the Bell inequalities. And so cubism's sort of take on this, well, you just reject lambda, and then you you evade these problems. And then more recently, there has been a long list of additional no-go theorems, in many ways sharpening up these earlier results. So the no-go theorems, starting from Pusey, Barrett, and Rudolph, to Wayne's 2018 paper, which just appeared on the archive, and you're probably going to talk about this later today. Again, I would say they strengthen the cubist case because they make it even harder to maintain there is a lambda. So, just some more detail on no-go theorems and lambda. So, well, I claimed I wouldn't say it again. Here it is again. The ontological model assumption formalized by Harrigan and Speckens is that for any measurement of a physical system, either the outcomes or the probabilities are determined by lambda, the system's real properties. And people have used hidden variables for that, or realism. They're in some ways misleading labels, and I'm not going to use them.
Why are they misleading?
Well, I mean, the lambda must not be hidden necessarily. So therefore, the word hidden variable is misleading. Realism would somehow imply that if you call this assumption realism, then if you deny it, you deny realism. Again, I think this is misleading.
Would you elaborate on that point later?
Yes.
Why deny it?
Okay, I will elaborate. I will tell you why it's sensible to call cubism realist, even though it rejects lambda. Okay, so some more detail about no-go theorems. Actually, I learned a lot of that from the paper by Harrigan and Rob, which I just mentioned. So 1927, Einstein. I mean, astonishingly early, proved the first no-go theorem, just in a short note. And saying, assuming lambda and locality, then it follows that psi, the wave function, cannot be in one-to-one correspondence with the hidden variables. So that's a sweet and precise argument he gave then. And then 8 years later, in this letter to Schrödinger, he proves that if you assume lambda and locality, then psi cannot be determined by lambda. But he actually doesn't spell out that conclusion. The conclusion, again, this is something I learned from what's Harrigan's first name? Nick, right?
Yeah.
Nick and Rob. That even though he doesn't spell it out, mysteriously, but his argument shows this unambiguously that this is the case. And then later on, there is the string of no-go theorems starting with PBR. Assuming lambda plus some further technical assumptions, and this most of the current work and discussions are about which of these assumptions are actually reasonable, which you can relax, etc., what you can replace them by. So assuming lambda plus further assumptions applies to psi is determined by lambda, so psi itself is actually a real set of affairs. And of course, we all know that assuming lambda and locality contradicts quantum mechanics at Bell. Okay. Let me just briefly mention the go through the ancient 1935 argument, just for those who come from different communities. It's often called the steering argument. So assume you have two parties A and B, which are separated by a long distance. Can think of enough different stars, if you like. And they share an entangled state, maximally entangled state. So 0 and 1 are the eigenstate of the spin z operator, spin upwards. And then it's a simple fact that you can just rewrite that state as a superposition of x eigenstates just in the same way. So that works with any direction. So these two are just equal. And now assume that a measurement at A is made, and you look at the conditional state after the measurement on A. So there are two possibilities, which I'm going to consider, that A measures the Z variable, then the conditional state just from the first expression is just either 0 or 1, depending on the outcome. Or A measures the X in the X direction, and then the conditional state will be either plus or minus. Either this way or that way, again, depending on the outcome. So let's repeat that. So that's just the same box repeated on the slide. OK, so if A measures X, and the result is either this or that. And if A measures X, the result is either that, this or that. Now, if and here comes now the Einstein argument. If psi B were a function of the real state of affairs at B, then that real state of affairs would depend on what A measures. Because in other cases, there are two non-overlapping sets of states. So the other argument says the real state of AB, this is just his words, consists precisely of the real state of A and the real state of B. And the two states have nothing to do with one another. This is a locality argument. So therefore, the real state at B cannot depend upon the kind of measurement I carry out on A. And then the implication that psi b is not a function of the real set at b, in that to my knowledge, was first made by Karl Kelch, Chris Fuchs, and myself in 2002, even though it's an obvious consequence of this. So therefore, psi b is not a function of the real set at b. Psi b is not a real property of the system at b. So that is Einstein's 1935 no-go result. Okay, so now, well, you could still, of course, reject quantum mechanics, but since last year, what was it, over 2 years ago, finally, loophole-free Bell experiments were performed, you now know that giving up quantum mechanics for these predictions is not an option, so you have to either give up locality or lambda, and cubism gives up lambda. So that's the starting point here. So that was my route, one via probabilities.
Sorry. I don't understand, what does it mean to give up lambda? Lambda is a sort of the hidden variables. What does it mean to give up hidden variables? I thought the hidden variables sort of have been introduced to sort of give a more realistic or different.
Okay.
Giving it up means sort of, you know, having even more problems.
Well, okay. I mean, giving them up is maybe not postulating them or not making use of them or denying their existence. So denying their existence is the right formulation, because giving up means they existed beforehand. And
you need to use something else, right?
Or nothing else.
No, I mean, you know, we have the EPR experiments and the Bell inequalities, and sort of either, you know, you have one of these existing interpretations of quantum mechanics, so either you need hidden variables or you have the...
Okay, so that's maybe it's an important question. So, I mean, basically look at these no-go theorems, and they are quite a complete list of things that have been. So this is the Bell inequalities, these are the Einstein arguments, these are the more recent. Yeah. They all assume the hidden variable. So it's not, if you want to, so they're all of the form assuming lambda, assuming the hidden variables, and making some other assumptions, you do have a contradiction. So therefore, it's clearly, giving up on lambda is clearly a way out of these problems, and this is exactly what we're doing.
How is it a way out? The Copenhagen interpretation also doesn't need lambda, so is that a way out? Or the multiverse interpretation also doesn't need lambda, is that the way out?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. But you could still, I mean, infinitely many hidden variables would still work, right? I mean, you know, I'm pretty out of physics, but it was...
But what do you mean by infinitely? No. There's no assumption.
Maybe what you mean is maybe non-local.
There's, of course, there's many ways of, you can relax other assumptions.
Okay.
Obviously, I mean, this is what people do. I'm not saying that the only way to avoid the contradictions inherent in these or not predicted by these theorems is to abandon lambda. That's not the only way of doing it. So, and other interpretations do other things.
Okay, so it's not possible if locality plus infinitely many hidden variables to make it work, so that's not a way out.
No, it's not.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. So now to probability. And that is actually, in a sense, historically, how cubism really, well, the first ideas came from probability theory. And let me start with De Finetti, who published in 1931 his paper Probabilismo, in which, I mean, he introduces the idea of probabilities as personalist degrees of belief, guiding decision. And so the slogan he introduced at the beginning of the paper is probability does not exist. Unless it means that it doesn't exist out there as an ontic or objective thing. Now that was, for many years, a fringe position, until Well, Savage in 1954 published the Foundations of Statistics, where he basically uses this notion of probability and comes up with a fully fledged decision theoretic derivation of probabilities and utility functions. So basically, he derives the von Neumann-Morgenstern utility decision theory from De Finetti style axioms, really. And this was extremely influential in economics. And so this is, I think, in economics still the standard way of thinking about probability and decision making. So the first time we, the first basically cubist paper in a way was this one in 2002 about quantum probabilities as Bayesian probabilities, where we postulate is that even in quantum mechanics, you should regard probabilities as personalist degrees of belief. Then Rob Speckens, 2004, wrote his beautiful toy theory paper. And there is an astonishingly long list of compelling arguments for why you should regard quantum states as epistemic. So probabilities derived from quantum states as degrees of belief. Now, this is done within an ontological perspective, but the arguments actually they can easily be carried over to a framework without lambda. So that was actually a big boost for the view, and so we spelled that out later on in 2013. This is a paper that spells out the personalist probability approach fully in cubism. So what is a decision theoretic personalist probability? Don't use the word Bayesian here, and I have a reason for not doing that, which I'm going to explain later. Yesterday, John already introduced this sort of definition of it's a definition of probability. It's a number used for decision making, and Savage showed that you can actually always reduce decision making to maximizing expected utility. It's just legitimate to talk about money. So it's a simplified version of the fully fledged decision theoretic argument. So a probability, my probability of an event P, well, of an event E, is P if I regard P dollars as the fair price of a lottery ticket that pays $1 if E occurs. That's the thing. And this is, astonishingly far-reaching consequences. You can, let me just say this thing. So you can show easily that my probabilities with this definition, they are valuations of tickets, they if they do not satisfy the rules of probability theory, then I can can be shown to incur sure loss. So if you want to avoid sure loss, you have to use probability theory, and this is a one-to-one thing. So you can show that this kind of sure loss is not possible, will not occur if your probabilities are consistent with the rules of probability theory. So this is why this leads immediately this no sure loss principle, or as the sure thing principle in economic theory, leads to a derivation of probability theory. If you adopt this, you can show that your probabilities have to obey probability rules. So here's a very, very simple example for this kind of argument. So let's say you assign probability equal to 1.5 to an event. Well, that means you regard $1.50 as a fair price for a ticket that pays a dollar in the best case. So that, of course, exposes you to a sure loss of at least 50 cents. It also gives an important argument. I mean, this doesn't force you. I mean, it doesn't mean that any transaction will lead to a sure loss, right? But it just means that you can actually write down one where your probability valuations, your beliefs, are inconsistent with the wish to avoid a sure loss. So probability theory is therefore, in this sense, can be viewed as a tool to detect inconsistency. And this is a very simple example here. So if you toss three coins, then this probability here Well, this is consistent. Probability of three heads equal to 0.5. Because for a single one, well, it's between 0 and 1. That's the only thing you have to make sure here. But in this example here, if you have the probability of at least getting at least two heads, or plus probability of getting at least two tails, if you assign 0.9 to that, that's not OK. That's inconsistent with probability theory. And so it would open you up to Dutch book, to Shor loss. So the lesson from this is that probabilities provide relations. So the theory provides relations between probabilities, but it does not tell you what the correct probabilities are. And the claim will be that the same is true in quantum mechanics. And for probability theory, I think that's essentially uncontroversial. Nobody would think that the theory alone tells you what that should be. But in quantum mechanics, the situation is very different, and this is why I'm drawing attention to this. I used the word normative quite a bit, and so I would like to just present this standard, this classic example, due to Allais, which also in the end was very influential. Well, first on Kahneman and Tversky. Kahneman just got a Nobel Prize in economics for this work, so this is actually the seed for a very important development. So here is a game. Oh, it's not a game. I mean, it's basically just a decision, almost a game. So you are offered either zero, nothing, or $5 million or $10 million. I increased these numbers slightly from our last original example for inflation. And you have a choice. I mean, in case one, you have a choice between 1A and 1B. In case two, between 2A and 2B. Now, in this case, the probabilities you're offered are, well, you just get 5 million with certainty. You just got handed 5 million. In the other case, you get nothing with probability 1%, 5 million with 89% probability, and 10 million with 10% probability. So that's that choice. And I mean, you can just think about what you would prefer. I would prefer this one here, 1A, quite definitely. Between 2A and 2B, now, I mean, you see the probability is slightly different. So 0 has 89% and 90% here. Here you get 5 million with 11%. Here you get 10 million with 10% probability. Now, if you do this experiment, many people will actually, in case 2, prefer B. Because they say, well, look, I mean, this is almost the same, right? 89, 90. I can't really distinguish that. There's just no difference between the two. And here I get 10 million. So that's a much better the price. Well, you can easily show that having different preferences, different directional preferences in these two cases is inconsistent. So therefore, and it's, I mean, these are strong intuitions. And they're actually very, I mean, they are, well, they led to the idea that economics is not a theory of rational relations. And of course, was clearly a breakthrough. The second is also very important in medical studies because, I mean, people are, I mean, you're not given these decisions, but for instance, you might have to make decisions about cancer treatment. And this is actually very similar things. They have very big stakes and probabilities, well, they're tricky. And depending on how they're presented, you might actually make very different decisions there. So this is a very relevant thing. So what do we have? The normative theory just told me that if I prefer this over this and this over this and I'm inconsistent, so I shouldn't. I should then probably, if I feel strongly about this, I should reconsider this or vice versa. So the normative theory tells me, well, I should make sure that I'm not guided by my rational impulses. But I have to somehow work hard, the normative struggle to make my decisions consistent. A descriptive theory tells me how agents act, how do irrational agents act, and this is of course what economists are mostly interested in. So the probabilities I am looking at in cubism are normative. not descriptive. They don't describe how actual physicists make decisions. Very brief aside, this really is a comment on a question that came up yesterday. There's about frequencies on repeated trials. Many physicists think about probabilities as frequencies. Now, I think that they're making a simple category mistake. Frequencies are data. Probabilities are, I mean, even if you just use formal theory, probabilities are correspond to a measure, and frequencies are data, so random variables. So they're just different things. And frequencies can be assigned probabilities. Probabilities can be refined on the basis of measured frequencies. So all this is fine, but it's important to keep them separately as two different concepts. And actually, a personalist approach is actually very nice, because if you were really serious about using frequencies as the basis for your probabilities, you would have to start by making a notion of a repeated trial fundamental, and that's tricky. That's certainly tricky in practice, because how does an experimenter actually know that the conditions don't change from trial to trial? So within a personalist theory, you can actually give a simple criterion within probability theory for what it means for trials to be repeatable. And the idea is this exchangeability introduced by De Finetti, and first De Finetti's representation theorem and the quantum version of this later. Now, Bayes' rule. So I've avoided, yes?
Sorry, can I ask something? If you said that your agents are rational, so say not humans?
I'm not saying they are rational. I'm just saying that the theory actually is a guide to a rational agent, to an agent who strives to be rational.
But then, isn't the best probability that the agent can give precisely the one where it imagines that there are many trials, and then there's a certain frequency, and in the limit, that frequency tends to a probability? Isn't that the best way?
Well, I mean, first of all, the condition for repeatability, again, is part of the agent's belief structure and his assumptions. So it's not an assumption the agent has to make. That's the first thing. So it's not a fact about the system that it is repeated. It's part of your belief structure. Secondly, there are many situations where this is not the case in that case. And thirdly, you're right. If I actually, I mean, this is really what the De Finetti theorem says. If you have an exchangeable situation, then you can actually link. I mean, at least you can show that there's certain their convergence. Your priors will converge to a posterior that is peaked where the frequencies are peaked, and so on.
Yeah. Can I have a follow-up question on this? I mean, usually we say that the probability is well defined for IID, identically prepared and independent systems. Mm. But would cubism go beyond that and then also assign a probability in the sense for a single trial, or?
Well, I mean, I should have stressed this more. This argument here, sorry, I'm too far. This argument here, this Schurlaus, this is a single case argument. Right. So there's nothing about repetition here. It's an argument that applies for a single. This sure loss, you just hand over $1.50 and you lost that single trial. So this is a single trial approach, and then I mean probability theory of course gives you the tools to apply that same theory to multiple trials. Multiple trials are simply, I mean, it's just a bigger sample space.
Does it mean that there will be a difference between prediction for many trials when you don't have IIDs between cubism and, let's say, standard approach?
Or if you make the same assumption, you get the same predictions. If you don't have IID, I mean, IID is a strong assumption.
So I abound this. I take now example where I do not have IID.
Yeah.
I guess the argument is whether it works beyond the IDF. For instance, if a Markov process, the dash push argument also works. It works well beyond IID.
Oh, yeah.
That dash push argument doesn't rely on IID. So if I have any other structure,
I mean, just gives you the probability calculus. It doesn't really give you a countable additivity, but you don't need this in practice anyway. So, but then you just use probability theory, which gives you Markov processes and everything. So you can use the full apparatus of probability theory. And I mean, if you look at the mathematical textbook for probability theory, you don't find frequencies in there. I mean, you start with measures, and this is really very similar to this in some sense. It's just more sophisticated. But,
maybe a little clarification to Gemma's question. In this Bayesian framework, is the probability that converges to the frequency? If you observe a set of long set of data, your update will converge to the frequency.
Exactly.
Or in the other approach, the frequentist approach, you really think that the probability is there in nature.
Oh, I see, yeah.
And the frequency converges to the probability.
Right.
I think here.
Right. That's a good point. That highlights the difference in focus. And about IID, I mean, this is often called, this kind of distribution is often called. It's a mixture of IID distributions. Okay, brief remark about Bayes' rule. So Bayes' rule in this form here is simply followed from consistency. It's a probability theory, follows from no sure loss. But now let's assume you want to use this, I mean, and P is here my probability on Wednesday. I just say, well, this is probability I have on Wednesday. And they must be consistent, and so this must be true for them. Otherwise, I would be inconsistent. Now, you want to just say, what if you want to use this for updating your probabilities, actually as an updating rule, which is often conflated? Well, assume now observe B on Thursday morning, right? So now the question is, well, people would normally say, well, then my probability, my Thursday probabilities of A should be just my conditional Wednesday probability conditioned on B. And that just doesn't follow from consistency or from Dutch book. I mean, these are two different probability assignments here, and this equality here does not follow, requires additional assumptions. And that, I think, is an important observation. It's, I mean, in some sense, an obvious observation, but I mean, people have worked about this quite thoroughly. And the thing, therefore, is that Bayesian updating is not fundamental. And so, therefore, calling cubism quantum Bayesianism has been the source of countless misunderstandings, because the focus is not on Bayesian updating. Bayesian updating isn't fundamental in cubism. So, a bit tongue-in-cheek, Chris Fuchs has proposed to call it quantum betabilitarianism, which is a term, not quantum, but betabilitarianism is a term that Oliver Wendell Holmes, a former US Supreme Court judge and pragmatist philosopher as well, introduced, I think, somewhat tongue-in-cheek for his philosophy. Okay, so now the Born rule, we have now similar things for the Born rule. Born rule, and this is just summarizing what John said yesterday very briefly. The Born rule can be also viewed as a normative consistency requirement. So if a quantum state rho here, then the Born rule just gives me a probability for giving certain measurement outcomes here. But if I introduce this reference measurement here, let's say that's a seek POVM, or just any information to complete POVM with the right properties, then my quantum state can be represented by a probability distribution for outcomes here, and my measurement can be represented by this matrix of conditional distributions. And so I can write my Born rule now simply as a relation between probabilities. And of course, I can also make this fundamental and just get rid of quantum states and everything, and just have a relation between probabilities.
Just to preempt a philosopher's distinction, instead of counterfactual, maybe you should have used hypothetical.
Hypothetical, very good, yeah. Sorry, this should be hypothetical, definitely, because it's a bad choice of word. Thank you. So it's a rule, and so the normal idea is that, well, these are given to you, and then that fixes this probability here. And in cubism, it's not that. It's not that this is primary and this is this comes first, and then this is determined by it, but it's simply a consistency rule between the terms of the left-hand side and the right-hand side. That's, I think, an important distinction here. Now we come to what I mentioned in my abstract. Actually, this conference, all the 2 weeks actually have been sort of bedeviled by bad orderings of talks. So last week, Markus gave 2 beautiful talks about his theory, which really should have belonged on this week's, I feel. And when I wrote my little abstract, I was expecting that the focus of this conference would be actually much more on your theory than it actually turns out to be. Furthermore, your talk this week comes after mine here, and mine comes after John's, and so on. Oh yeah, and also when the algorithmic information talks, they were also in the wrong order yesterday and today. So time travel seems to be the only option here. Now, this is Markus' postulates on one page. I apologize for condensing them in this form. So it first defines observers. Every observer is described by an observer graph. Actually, I say what an observer graph is. It's just a computable, rooted, directed graph over the finite binary strings. So you have just binary strings, and this is just a rooted, directed graph, a tree. And there's also an ahistory, is simply a path through this observer graph. So this is the term I use here. So every observer is described by an observer graph A. And this is interpreted as the complete list of all observations that the observer successively experiences. Let me just read it once, because I screwed this up. Every observer is described by an observer graph A, the complete list of all observations that the observer successively experiences corresponds to the sequence of binary strings in an A history, which is just a path for this. That's the first postulate. Second one, if the observer experiences an A history, the observer will subsequently experience one of the strings from the set of possible next strings. So this is not A of xn. So if you look at this tree, you will see, given that A history, there is a set of possible next string A of xn. And this will be chosen at random. And the probability is given by this conditional algorithmic probability here, which is objective. This is just this is an objective stochastic process. So by a random walk through this tree, given by these, given by Solomonov induction. So these are the other 2 postulates of the theory. And it's stunning how much you can actually get from that. I'm a great admirer of this piece of work, even though I'm going to. Basically, what Markus asked me, well, could this describe a cubist observer, cubist agent? And so I'm going to disagree with that. So the key prediction, certainly a key prediction of your theory, is that with high probability, observers see simple probabilistic laws of nature, your quotes, and find themselves to be part of a larger dynamical system that they may call the universe. So the universe or the world and the laws emerge from the stochastic process. Right? So observers are fundamental and in this theory, and they participate in the creation of the world. So that sounds very cubist in some sense, right? And so now I'm going to tell you why this is not compatible with cubism nevertheless. So first of all, let's look at probabilities. So in Markus' case, you have a fundamental stochastic process governed by these objective, almost ontic, conditional algorithmic probabilities of y given x given a. But as I said, I mean, this is sort of like Bayesian updating, right? So that's not fundamental in cubism. So in cubism, you have a set of normative consistency criteria. It's a very different flavor. And what Bayesian updating is not fundamental. And furthermore, I would say, I mean, one reason for looking at cubism is also to allow for this kind of thing. It's maybe a bit sort of overly bloomy here. It's a world teeming with novelty. I mean, in a stochastic process seems, well, I shouldn't say this, because of course you show that a lot can actually, it can give rise to a lot. But I would claim that that the creativity of the world that cubism would like to capture is not captured by a stochastic process. The question, what's an agent? This is a question that cubists have often been tortured with, because the claim is, well, you have to define an agent within the theory. And we claim, no, you don't have to do this. But Marcus does that. An agent is, put agent in brackets, you call it observer, but that's the same idea. He's described by an observer graph A, period. Now, if you look at cubism standard 4, where measurement apparatus is conceptually an extension of the agent, well, that really means that agent is a more fluid concept than could be captured by this theory. So boundary between agent and the world is fluid. And I mean, it even extends to I'll give you an example from economics. So if a couple, husband and wife, let's say, share a bank account, then to an important degree, they actually are a single economic agent, because if they make decisions if they assign probabilities which are actually not consistent with each other, then they can be Dutch booked jointly. So therefore, there should be regarded as one agent. And the same is true in cubism. You could easily, there are many situations where it's reasonable to let's say, regard, look at decisions that your family is taking as one, and then basically that family is the cubist agent.
But that would be consistent, right? You could just assign a state to your family.
Okay, maybe.
Call it the vertex of this.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying this is the final word. This is a word on this. It's just a number of challenges which... I mean, if you really, of course, you might not even want to make this look like cubism, but maybe the most serious one is this one here. So in Marcus theory, observers are fundamental and the world emerges. So this is really a form of idealism. In cubism, both agents and the world are fundamental. I think that's a very fundamental difference. And so the very starting point of cubism is the agent's action on the external world. So that's the primitive. It's a measurement, an action the agent takes on the world, and the new thing that's created in that action. So therefore, I would claim that cubism is not idealism, but is what we call participatory realism. And that's really all I have to say for my elaboration on realism. Thanks for your attention.
We have time for questions.
What kind of assumptions do you need to add to get Bayesian activities?
Okay, there's two things. You can actually make an argument that's called diachronic coherence. And so if on Wednesday, this is maybe we should go back here. If on Wednesday you, this is what you're referring to, yeah? So if on Wednesday you would like to sort of commit to an updating strategy, then this diachronic coherence argument shows you that this is the only coherent way of doing it. It's called diachronic coherence. It's
it's
consistency. No, not consistency in time. You see what you commit to on Wednesday to actually update like that. So this is then therefore a commitment at one point in time, to which you can then apply the usual no sure loss arguments. So it applies to, that means that the only coherent updating strategy, a strategy you commit to now, is Bayesian updating. Well, once you actually, it's Thursday and you suddenly learn new things you hadn't taken into consideration before, etc. And there's no requirement at all to actually sort of stick to that. So that's this is what I wanted to capture.
If you refer to a single time instance, then Bayesian updating is the only consistent way.
It's the only consistent way if you want to plan now how to behave in the future. If you want to commit now to your updating strategy.
Is it possible to describe the things that you take to be real in the Keybazin approach? Because you said it's realized, so there must be.
It's not possible to describe it. Cubism is not descriptive as a theory. It is strictly, the theory is strictly about.
There is reality, but you can't describe it. Is that right?
You can't describe it in cubism, that's correct, yeah. I wouldn't say that this describing it is necessarily impossible, but the theory.
That means you can't say which aspects of the theory are real.
Well, I think I would have an answer to that. I mean, since the theory mostly consists of rules and probabilities and quantum states on the one hand and rules on the other hand, I would say the states and probabilities are not real, but the rules are.
Yes, the rules are real. The rules are the things that live at sort of.
In the sense that, I mean, any age, the rules are normative for any age, and so in that sense, they're certainly objective, and you can call them real.
Is there more stuff that's real beyond the rules?
Well, I would say the world is certainly is real. I mean, there's a real world on which I act. It's just not the subject of the theory. The theory is about decision making.
Okay, so there is a real world,
yeah.
But you don't describe it within the theory.
Yes.
And even nevertheless, if there is a real world, couldn't one assert that it should have a description?
I don't know.
Because that would be a way to get Lambda back into the picture.
Yeah, it's the question is, do you want a description? And
it's not necessarily having the description, but to assert that there exists a description. I'm just trying to.
Yeah, I mean, there's no such assertion in cubism that there exists.
But if there's an assertion that it's realist, then I'm concerned that means that there is.
Well, okay, I mean, this is about the term. So, I mean, if that's what you mean by realist, then no, it's not realist.
There are some
technical.
Technical notion of realism which doesn't entail that. That's my difficulty.
Yeah. I mean, okay. I think very simply, if you compare to Marco's idealism, well, I mean, there's clearly, I mean, assuming existence of a real world is clearly different as an approach. So yes.
Yeah, that's clear.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, like, because from. Just what you say, it's like basically there is this coherence that is achieved at the level of like individual engine, and I'm wondering like how you would go with the some sort of like forms, what would be like prescriptions for achieving intersubjective coherence, and by this I mean like for example like as a model like in general relativity, yes, there is like a specific. I mean, this can be sidetracked from locality, but like in general, there are like two different forms of like ways of like setting how different agents are intersubjectively maintaining the mutual coherence of descriptions. One is like local Lorentz transformations, another is like you can do parallel transport vectors like and like. You have some input from curvature and so on. And I'm wondering, like, as long as I'm, like, more interested not only, like, my own consistency when I do whatever actions betting on outcomes of quantum systems, but, like, I'm interested, like, in, like, some sort of, like, something that would be, like, closer to the daily intuition of physicists as practitioners that, like, maybe is encoded in this like ontic realism, doesn't have to be, like how one would go with like intersubjectivization of it. I know that like I versed it like in grammatically more circular form, but I hope it's understandable.
Well, I mean, there's no requirement for intersubjective agreement. So the only thing I can say is that if
the
you...
The question is how you would, like if
yeah,
you
I could... For instance, if I model another agent, then I might expect agreement. So that's the way of planning this. Oh no, it's not a joke. I mean, if I... even my intuitive model of you, I mean, basically, if I tell you, well, look back and see what you see on the wall, and I expect you to say a clock. This is my model of you. It doesn't require a sort of a theory of or a prior assumption of intersubjective agreement.
It's true. I'll just add like one thing here. So like, this is how I understand like what Marcus does, and I may be wrong, so like please correct me if I'm wrong, but like somehow like in Marcus' case, because of like imposition of specific mathematical structure, like there is this like way of asserting how like certain descriptions by different agents can be like at least perceived as converging to certain like intersubjective coherence. And I think that like here, like this distinction that you made between cubism and like this what is done by Marcus, like somehow like in my view, maybe I'm wrong, but it somehow like it's precisely like about like if I think it's cutting out this providing some structure, mathematical structure for intersubjectivity is like strength naturally for like individual coherence, but one loses this like control over, because like I look there at this clock and we agree, but somehow like I think that like physicists like to actually like control the like have like mathematical tools of control of the intersubjectivity. And this example of GR was intended to be so.
Yeah, it's a very different set of assumptions, and so if you take it seriously, you could, I mean, you should really try to reformulate some, or try to formulate relativity in terms of in these terms. And I think it's actually possible to quite some degree. Probably, totally, but I haven't done it.
My question was similar to Lucien's, and I suspect that it would be the beginning of a long discussion between me and Rüdiger, and I don't particularly want to impinge on the coffee break, so maybe I'll postpone it for later.
Okay. I have a question. Would you accept the notion of a hypothetical agent, the one that is not present?
A hypothetical agent.
In front of the measurement apparatus, for example.
Well, yes, certainly. I can write down the probabilities that I would expect this hypothetical agent, for the answers I would expect the hypothetical agent to give me if I were to ask him, yes. In that sense, this agent wouldn't be different from any other hypothetical system. In that.
So one reason why a lot of people feel discomfort about the Dutch book justification for coherence is that it sort of tries to justify this epistemic constraint on beliefs in this decision theoretic, almost pragmatic setting of betting, right? So the discomfort is over suddenly in a betting setting, but isn't that an additional assumption? Why would an agent be willing to bet at all? Why wouldn't he, in principle, refuse to bet or whatever? So I don't want to initiate that discussion here, but...
You have done it already. So.
I just want to remark, maybe note that a lot of people in recent years have, a lot of formal epistemologists have tried to come up with a different justification in terms of accuracy. So the idea there is that if you're not coherent, then you are guaranteed to have beliefs that are more off from what the actual outcomes of of the offense you have beliefs about are than someone who would be coherent. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure whether this is actually more fitting in the humanism account, but
yeah, I mean, it's less fitting for a humanist account because it already looks at. See, in cubism, two agents can't see the same thing. So that's because it's really a single agent theory. How I act in my actions on the world, and that actually also gives you the answer to your first part, the one you didn't want to initiate. The starting point actually is even on the slide. The very starting point is an agent's action on the external world. So the action actually is basically you have to gamble all the time. I mean. You gamble when you walk across the street. Any decision you make is a gamble because you actually need to weigh the possible outcomes.
But if you're betting with someone, that also presupposes that there is someone you're with, looking together at the event after which.
Oh no, I'm not. No, I'm not gambling. So the way that the Dutchburg argument works, if you write it out in this, it's strictly about my expectations. So basically, if I want. A normative theory that guides my action. I want that to be. I mean, I want to be able to trust it. So, if in that set of probabilities of decisions that would be endorsed by my theory, if there were ones that give me a direct loss, if I can just look in my own sort of see, and you see, well, there's a sure loss here, then I would stop trusting that normative set of rules. So this is by, this is how it works. It's single agents is about my own preferences. It's about trusting this normative formalism for decision making, and basically not wanting an inconsistency because that would destroy the whole thing. That's the. Idea. Coffee?
I think that's what the speaker suggests.